Okay, the recording has begun. I'd like to begin this evening by recognizing our sponsors. And this evening, we have two different sponsors. We've got Adele and Hai Itzkwe sponsoring in memory of Adele's grandmother, Rose Perlich, Reza Lechana Bat Menachem Fisher, Lelea Shalom. And we have Elaine and Larry Grossman sponsoring in memory of Larry's father, Hyman Grossman, Harav Chaim Zev, Ben Reb Meir, Oliver Shalom. In the Shemot Havaliot, our learning is in their memory, and may their memory be a blessing. Thank you for your sponsorship, and I wish you well. It is good to see you all. We didn't have Parsha under pressure last week. I was moving under pressure last week, but we've since moved. I wouldn't say we're under less pressure, but just different pressure. And it is a pleasure to feel rooted in this neighborhood together as we turn to a parasha that is all about land possession and rootedness and attachment and value. And last week, of course, we had Lag BaOmer, and it was this time when news started coming in of what had unfolded in Israel, the horrors that we've now had a week to try to process. And it's not got that much easier to process. And I know a number of you have family in Israel. A number of you have family who are the year off on Israel, and it feels very close to home for many of us. If you do have anything you would like to reach out to me about, you're welcome to, of course. But it's a very difficult time, and I just want to recognize that still. So thank you for our sponsors. Thank you for being here. Let us turn to, as long as my voice will carry me, through Parshat Bahar and Bechukotai. And in many ways, this is an incredibly odd set of Parshiot, because you would be forgiven for reading this and thinking, we're done. It's Simchas Torah and we're finished. Because that's the kind of tenor that these parashiot have. We're speaking about Shemitah, land issues. We're talking about economies, how to function values in the land, how to bring various korbanot, promises of blessing if you follow the way of God, threats of curses if you don't. And it feels almost like we're at the end. And of course, biblical critics in the 18th century suggested this was the end of one sacred text that was then redacted and stuck in the middle of another one to make Leviticus. But it was really put together by what they labeled P, the priestly clan, and some pre-rabbinic sages mushed it together. And that's the critical way of resolving what seems to be out of place. But of course, as with all the apparent inconsistencies the critics discover, or so to speak, discover, it's hard to be a rational reader and not notice these inconsistencies. Of course, the rabbinic sages 2,000 years ago were aware of what looked like inconsistencies, surprises in the text. We've noted, of course, repeatedly the most famous apparent inconsistency, which we sing about every Friday night, Shamar v'zachar v'dibur echad, that in the Ten Commandments, that they're put in two different locations, Parshat Vayetzanan and Parshat Yitro, there are differences. And this is meant to be a transcription of Revelation, the literal words that God said. And they're different in different places. It's hard to escape that. And of course, the sages proposed a solution, which we sing every Friday night, that yes, there is something remarkable about this text in that it is a transcription, not of a human speech, but of divine dictation, which means it will break the rules of rational language on occasion. But the solution, one of the main solutions actually cited by the Sforno as to why on earth we start talking as if we're at the end of a book when we're at the end of the book, when we're really just at the end of the middle volume, is essentially a fatal misunderstanding is that Moses was under the impression, quite reasonably, that they were about to make it into the land. that the whole book of Bamidbar, we know it exists, but the five books of Moses is a retrospective title. It could have been the three books of Moses. And that's exactly what Moshe was hoping. He was hoping, we've been through Bereshit, we've been through Gan Eden, we've been evicted, we made it through time of Noah, the time of the Tower of Babel, the patriarchs and the matriarchs, we made it through slavery in Egypt, we were freed, we built a Mishkan, we've now laid out the laws and the rituals. We know how we're going to serve God, how society is going to function. We did Vayikra Yutet 19, which has got all the central ethics, the loving one's neighbor like oneself, respecting one's parents, observing agricultural cycles, dealing with chukim, statutes that we are beyond our capacity to scrutinize. And now Moshe tries to wrap up, and to some degree, maybe it was that urgency on his part that unleashed what was to come. But of course, we'll get to the book of Bamidbar, and they begin to form the camp. Well, after we finish Baharim B'chukotai, Bamidbar begins with a count, which is almost as if to say, we're now going to get into the land. Let's do a first census. They just published the American census 2 weeks ago, which came out with all sort of terrible news, describing decline and making everybody worried. But it's important to do censuses. And Bamidbar begins with the census as if to say, we're about to go in. And then, of course, Parshat Shlach, there's a pause, and they say, hold on, let's just send in some emissaries to scout out the land, which of course, as we get to the book of Bamidbar, we'll be able to discuss whether this scouting was conceived in sin, whether it was an optimistic notion, acceptable or not. But essentially, the bad report comes back, and a 40-year halt is put on the journey to Israel. But at this point, at the end of Vayikra, Israel was within their grasp. They were weeks out, weeks from being in the land. And Moshe starts going through the details of this week's parsha, but it was not to be. So in many, and the truth is, as this is divine dictation, God could have said, okay, Moshe, take this material and stick it at the end. We're not going to leave this weird bump in the middle of the five books where it looks like an ending and produces what Frank Comeau calls a sense of an ending, and then we kind of pick up again. I don't know how many of you ever heard somebody give a class or a speech where it sounds like they're about to end, and you get ready, and then they keep going, and they're like 14 endings. I think I heard, I see from your faces that you've been in many of such speeches. Rabbi J.J. Schachter once said, thank God for Mashiach, because without Mashiach, rabbis would never stop speaking. Because rabbis always finish by saying, B'mhevi ameinu amen. And if they didn't know how to land, some of the rabbis just circle and circle and circle until they say, and may that bring the Mashiach, amen. So that's how we land. Actually, that I want major lesson in public speaking. If one is planning to give a speech or a shir or a dvar Torah or anything, you don't always have to plan every line of every sentence, but at least for me, you have to plan the first sentence and the last sentence. Because learning how to land can get one into a lot of trouble. Where I met Miriam in Los Angeles on a YU Kollel, there were a small group of us that went out for the summer. And one of the, we were all for the first time essentially standing up and speaking to a community. They trusted us for some reason. With this, and the young man who I was rooming with in LA got up to speak between Mincha and Maariv one evening. And that's not a long slot. Between Mincha and Maariv, they give you 5 minutes before they shoot you. And this is America, so that's not a turn of phrase. He started speaking, and he got to what sounded like the end of the content that he had prepared. But he just kept going, kind of repeating it in different words. And at one point, he looked over to me and he just said, help! So at that point, I just stood up and said, Rabbi Chazan ben Akash, Arutz HaKadosh Baruch Hu, L'Zakot Eid Yisrael. And actually, he learned a lesson that you have to prepare the last sentence. But I also learned a very valuable lesson, because that evening, there was a family who were not that observant and were observant and had moved away from religion during a period of great personal difficulty. They had a bereavement of a young member of the family, and they were struggling through that, and they came back for the Yahrzeit, and they were saying Kaddish. And they obviously don't know the dynamic between me and my roommate. And to them, it looked like I basically stood up and cut him off and said, Reb Chanan ben Akash for the Kaddish Baruch Hu. And they came to me afterwards and said, look, I want to try to judge favorably. I've got a really bad taste in my mouth about religion. Generally, I'm here out of respect for my father, etc. And I just want you to explain to me how you could mistreat him so much, how you could be so disrespectful of him. At which point I was taken aback and surprised. But that was a helpful lesson. I don't know how I could have resolved it better, but at least they were gracious enough to come over and express their displeasure in a calm way so that I could then say, actually, we're roommates. I was trying to help him. So either way, we have to learn our last sentences to know how to finish. And it's odd, as we said, that in the middle of the five books, we come to an end. And what it seems to be, intentionally, for the Sforno and others, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching us that sometimes we think things are going to end, and they don't. And we have to always carry with us the doubt that we can predict what's coming. And I don't want to be ominous in any way at any point. But I think probably to some degree, we all feel like this pandemic is drawing to a close, coming to an end. And it is my fervent prayer, not to predict that it's not, but my fervent prayer that it is. But that we should remain vigilant and prepared for whatever may come to help each other continue through this process. But in that spirit, let's hope that it is next week, Shavuot, we'll, please God, be having food in the shul for basically the first time since last Purim, when we were, I don't know how many of you remember, how many of you had already decided not to come, where we had decided that there was going to be food, but there were going to be servers, and no masks, but gloves, which of course now we know you should put the glove on your face and you can have bare hands, but how things change. Now, so that's the beginning, entry point to Bahar Ruach HaKodesh, that it looks like an ending, and it's not, which is a fundamental lesson. And Bamidbar, when we get next week, and just to let everybody know, next week at this time, exactly this time, 8:45, we'll all have the privilege to hear from Rabbi Hochberg, who'll give us some Divrei Chizuk and Dvar Torah in advance of Shavuot, and maybe a few minutes in advance I'll come on, and if we've got a few minutes, I'll just share a thought about Parashat Bamidbar. But Bamidbar is a mess. I mean, we'll get there, but it is, for those of you that have Rabbi Jonathan Sacks' Covenant Conversation, they're obviously the online pieces. They publish them as books as well. And his introduction to the Book of Bamidbar is a fabulous introduction. And its fundamental question that the introduction seeks to solve is, what on earth is going on? The Book of Bamidbar is so bizarre. It seems to, in chronological terms, it stretches and it skips. There are parashot that take 40 years and there are parashot that take 10 minutes. It seems to repeat a lot of information we've already had. The Jewish people literally are circling. Everybody's making errors and mistakes. Moses is making errors. Aaron and Miriam are making mistakes. There's a talking donkey. There's a revolution in the camp. It's an incredibly odd book, which will come to address each of those episodes. But we were so close to an ending here, and then all sorts of terrors are unleashed, so we'll come to that. So let's have a look at a little closer detail, what an ending could have looked like. What are the kind of things that Moshe had prepared them to end with? And of course, the Book of Devarim, which is the actual ending, is radically different. We do not get the same information in Devarim, and there's an entirely different emphasis. And in many ways, we get the opportunity to have a couple of lessons here. Number one is that we can act prematurely and imagine that things are over before they are. And that's why God leaves this ending here. But also that endings can change. We can learn from false endings. And what Moshe prioritizes after the Book of Bamidbar is radically different to the ending he proposes here. And I guess, spoiler alert, the focus in Devarim, if you were to pick three words or one word, what would be Moshe's priority as he gives his final speeches for 5 weeks?
Don't sin.
Don't sin. That's a good emphasis generally. A bit more specific. And how do you preemptively, not just don't sin, but how do you preempt the possibility of sin? What is always called the silver bullet to resolving any cultural issue? Begins with Ed, and it ends with
education.
There you go. Education. And this is, it's often claimed by those who are in diplomatic circles dealing with crises in the middle, from anywhere from the Middle East to what was called the Troubles in Ireland, the terrors of Kosovo and elsewhere, is that, of course, there are kind of stopgap solutions to stop people killing each other. But long term, the silver bullet to any cultural crisis is education, is taking the next generation and not teaching them to hate each other and finding ways to teach them to cooperate with each other and respect each other. And of course, that's a political solution to a political crisis. But what Moshe learns is, over the course of Bamidbar, and I don't mean to say this pejoratively, like we all know this and Moshe had to figure it out, but we're, of course, the beneficiaries of what Moshe discovered and learned, is that sin is always an inevitability, and not just sin in the I betray God sense, but in the I betray my neighbor sense, the dishonesty, a lack of integrity, failure to uphold value, all those things are constantly surrounding us. And education is the key. We have to constantly train ourselves at each moment and re-educate ourselves. Continuing education is often a feature of various careers, whether you're a lawyer, a doctor, an accountant, sometimes even a rabbi, they've got continuing education courses. But of course, what we do as Jews is we're trained to learn perpetually. We are perpetual students, and not just of the vast corpus of learning that's been produced over the centuries, but over we relearn what it means to be human. We go over material. And Moshe shifts his focus from the laws we're about to see that are essentially about economic values and how to run a society to the principle of teaching the young and reinforcing education. So that's a spoiler alert for what's coming. But in this week's parsha, what could the end have looked like if this was to come? So he begins by describing the laws of Shemitah. And the truth is, these two parashot in many ways are the most alien for us. Although Korbanot is not something we practice now, so most of Vayikra can feel alien, there are a lot of details in this week's parasha that feel more alien because they in theory could happen without a temple. It talks about agricultural practices. It's talking about land ownership. It's talking about civil law that we just don't practice. So it feels distant, walled cities. So Rishon, a Parsha Bahar, we're told about Shemitah and the famous verse that's engraved on the, what's it called, Liberty Bell, appears in this week. Parsha, may liberty be proclaimed throughout the land. How do you say liberty in Hebrew? He's on our screen.
Hey, what?
Okay, Rut. And was that drawer saying, Leo saying drawer? There you go. Excellent. There you go. Drawer. It does depend how you translate the word drawer. And in fact, it is a incredibly rare word in biblical Hebrew, which leads a number of the commentators to pick up verses from Isaiah and Hosea and elsewhere where the word drawer seems to appear, relating to birds. Who are kind of fly free in the air. There's an Aramaic assumption that it means ledarer, to dwell wherever you can. So it actually means freedom of movement. But drawer is proclaimed throughout the land. A shofar is blown and all the servants and slaves are set free. All the ancestral homelands are returned to their rightful owners, with the exception of land within walled cities. There is a deep attachment to land throughout these parashiyot. Somehow, when you come to a metropolis or cosmopolitan area, a walled city that's really urban, there's less attachment to the soil, to to the land itself, more attachment to space, but you can sell that without it coming back. Sheni is all about selling property. Shlishi, we get promises from God that if you keep Shemitah, you'll be okay. And in many ways, that's also why this feels quite remote. That if, you know, if somebody were to come to you today and say, keep Shabbat, and I promise you, if you keep Shabbat, the money you make in 6 days is going to be more than you could ever make if you work 7 full days, we may not take them so seriously. But this is what we get promised in the biblical text, and it feels remote because our providential lives don't really function. It seems in this way. I remember there was a big debate that broke out in Yeshiva in Gush when I was there. There was 1 year where it was essentially classified as a drought. It hadn't rained for months and months and months. We made it into the winter. It really hadn't rained. They always speak about the height of the Kinneret. It was the lowest it had been in decades. And a number of the rabbinic authorities in Israel wanted to institute a day of fasting. And in the real sense, you know, when you think about fasting in the book of Esther, that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to put ash on and laying the special laning for a fast day, essentially put in place what had really been practiced for a very long time. And some of the rabbis at Gush said, we should. I mean, it says in Kriyat Shema, every day we say the second paragraph, where God promises rain if we're good and not rain if we're not good. So there's no rain, clearly we're not good. And another couple of the Rosh Yeshiva at Gush suggested that that's not quite how we experience providence anymore. And to suggest that a lack of rain is a direct result of misbehavior on our part opens a can of worms to all sorts of questions about terrorism and suffering and the Shoah. And you start drawing a line between God's will and our reality in a fundamental way. And that's a Pandora's box. And some people are willing to accept that Pandora's box and say, yes, when we suffer, there's a reason. And sometimes we don't know, but we should do something about it. But that seems to be fundamentally rooted in the theology we get in this week's parsha. In Ravi, we read about when there are difficult times and people have to sell their land. In Chamishi, we get the walled cities and the Ari Levian, the Levite cities. And then we're given some principles of charity. And one of the most fundamental principles that was used against Jews for much of medieval history was that one cannot lend with interest. Who are we not allowed to lend money to with interest?
Jews.
Who are we allowed to lend to with interest?
Non-Jews.
Everybody else. Right. People who are not Jewish, which is why we became the money lenders of medieval world, because it was religiously acceptable to us to engage in that occupation. But the other faiths that Judaism spawned, Christianity and Islam, they took that value and disseminated it among their own faith, that you cannot lend with interest. And usury is what it was called, became a signature sin. So not only did they outsource money lending to Jews, I mean, who in their right mind would lend commercially, not for interest? Of course, if you know, you've got a friend who needs help, if you've got a family member who needs help, you may lend without wanting interest. But commercially, there's no way you would do that. Although my understanding is there are Islamic banks right now that function on that basis and have loans without interest. I turn to the bankers among us for more details on that, how they make any money. And maybe it's just not from their lending. Chip, do you know about it?
No.
All right. So someone's going to have to look into this.
They make money from the calendar.
What'd you say, Ellie?
They make money from the calendars.
They make money from the calendars. Okay, that's good to know. All right. Maybe we should make some calendars and we can lend without interest. So, and Christianity took this writ large that one cannot lend at interest, which of course made it impossible for anybody to want to lend money. And I will note, usury, because no one was doing it, was seen as horrific. Now, in halachic life, Jewish banks exist in Israel, elsewhere. A number of American banks at different points in time have been owned, founded, executed by Jews. They lend with interest. And there is a halachic workaround for a business commercial context called heter iska, meaning in the context of commerce, it makes sense that you should be able to lend at interest. And so I'll ask you a question. What is wrong with lending with interest? Why is that forbidden? Fundamentally, what's wrong with it? Is it a chok, meaning it's like kashrut? God told us, so we don't do it. Or is there a rationale?
Takes advantage of a person when they're down.
Takes advantage of a person when they're down. Interesting. Okay. Everybody agree? Disagree? Let me ask you a question. If I were to ask you to think of a commercial profession that essentially caters to people who are vulnerable, what, you know, in isolation, if we hadn't been speaking about money lending or usury, I just said, give me a profession where your service is being provided to someone vulnerable. Which profession might you pick?
Psychology.
Psychology. Excellent. And psychology being a branch of, let's say,
social sciences.
Yes, social science.
Okay, social science. That's true, academically, psychology. But when it's being practiced, as you've suggested, Grace, you practice psychology. Medicine. Right. I think writ large, we would say as a profession, it's a branch of the medicine, medical sciences, even if it operates by slightly different rules and qualifications and boundaries. It's their treating. It's a form of treatment, let's say. And if I were to tell you to pick a profession that's primary service or primary clients, we call patients who are in need of treatment, who depend on you, who are vulnerable, it would be the medicinal sphere, right? And there's nowhere, anywhere in the Torah that says you cannot make money from healing, that you shall not charge for healing. It's well understood that medical expenses are included. If somebody gets injured, doctors don't have to be doctors without borders and doctors without income. And it's odd that when it comes to lending money, it's seen as sinful, meaning I'm providing a service for somebody in need. If I lend them money, I'm giving something up. I'm giving them a resource that they don't have. In the same way that if I need somebody to build me a roof and I don't know how to build, and I need a construction team to come in, I'm vulnerable. I need a roof. They come in and they build a roof. And I don't say, don't charge me. That's not nice. And I don't say, just charge me for the materials, even though I was vulnerable, right? So it's odd that if somebody provides me the service that they're giving me money to use that I didn't have, that I needed to make sure I'm not vulnerable.
Hi, Jake. You went for the second opinion?
It's suddenly seen as usury, which comes all sorts of connotations. So do we have another possible avenue to suggest why lending money at interest? You're providing a service.
Yeah.
What would be wrong? Yeah. Go on, Ellie.
Yes, because in those days it was man to man, and from one person to another person to lend money would be considered rude or usury. But I don't think they had any commercial lending at that time. So therefore, almost all of it was from one person to another. And therefore, how could you charge money how could you borrow money and charge interest to a friend?
Okay, interesting. So you're suggesting, meaning your reading of this narrows this prohibition dramatically. So this is not a prohibition on lending with interest. This is a prohibition of lending. This is essentially a form of charity to friends, is the way you're reading it. And I'd say that's the way that Jewish tradition reads it too, which is why there are certain inbuilt exceptions for business commercial matters. But somehow it developed in Christianity a stain. I mentioned a couple of times I've been teaching Dante this semester, And I'll note that it is in the seventh circle of hell. And if you're going to Dante's hell, the bigger the number, the worse it is. You want to be in the first circle, because actually in the first circle, nobody's being punished. In the ninth circle, Satan is chewing you for eternity. And the seventh circle, you're not doing so well. And that's where the usurers are. In fact, in Dante's seventh circle, it is called the circle of violence. Now, if you were picking where usury would be, I don't think you'd put it in a circle of violence. And that's where he puts it. And it's an astonishing place to put it. And it gives us an insight into how Christianity viewed money lending. Because the way Ellie's expressed it is essentially in the same way that if somebody's impoverished and needs money from you, that you have a biblical obligation, if it is within your means, an obligation to give them money for free, not just to not lend with interest, but to not lend. If somebody's in a situation of need and we do have means, we all have an obligation to give them free charity. And Ellie essentially says, this is the same spirit where we're talking about being charitable to friends or family in need. But in Christianity, it took an entirely different flavor, which then attached itself to Jews. And this is how he does it. In the seventh circle of hell, the circle of violence, there are three realms. People who are violent against three different kinds of victims. Now, what kind of victims can there be? If you divide the cosmos, or let's say existence, into three types of being, what kind, and I'm trying to be as, give as much a giveaway as I can. How many different types of being might you construe if there were three? What kind of beings might they be in existence?
Shlemiel, Shlemazel, and what else?
Excellent. Shlemiel, Shlemazel, and one more. Good job.
Angels, humans,
hey.
And
God.
Animals.
Excellent. So these are all good options. And the way that Dante divides it actually is between self, other, and God. He doesn't quite get angels involved here, although they do appear in the Inferno elsewhere. But those who are violent against others are the first punished in the seventh circle. And here you meet a couple of historic figures. You meet Attila the Hun, you meet Alexander the Great. And this is the realm of tyrants who were violent against others. And within each of these three realms, he divides the violence into two parts, violence against bodies and violence against possession. And he says tyrants who exploited and killed and stole from people damaged others both in body and in possession. And do you know what their punishment is for eternity? You take a wild guess, you never get it. None of his punishments are really that intuitive. So you're
listening to sermons for the rest of eternity.
No, that's in the ninth circle.
Hello.
So in the seventh circle, these tyrants, that's a good one. So the tyrants are punished by being boiled in a river of blood for eternity. And if they try to emerge out, there is a roving group of centaurs who fire arrows at them to kick them back in. So that's the tyrant. Who are violent against others. The second circle, which is, and as I was teaching this to the students, I tried to preface this as a very complicated realm with a lot of sensitivities that are pushed in the modern age. But then we've got violence against self, and violence against self in body and in possession. So the violence against self in possession for Dante are those who essentially spent their money without thinking and destroyed their own items, essentially were transgressed what we in Jewish thought called Baal Tashchit. They just didn't care about possessions and they were happy to damage and break. I don't know if any of you saw Toy Story at any point. The neighbor, Sid, I think his name is, no offense to the Sids here, spent his days basically damaging and ripping his toys apart and setting them on fire, which terrified the living toys from next door. It's interesting. Damaging property has featured in interesting ways in Israeli law, in American law, elsewhere. Do you think it's legal in America to destroy your own property? anyone got suggestions that it might be illegal to destroy? Let's say I decide, you know, I've got a pile of books here. I want to burn them. Anything stopping me?
No.
No. Is there anything that, if it's mine in capitalist America, that I bought it and it's mine, that it is illegal for me to destroy?
I think the flag.
Again, Leo?
Yeah.
Currency.
It is illegal to destroy currency because if you do it on a large enough scale, you manipulate the economy. I'm not sure if that's the only reason, but it is a crime to destroy currency. Diane says it may be criminal to destroy the flag. I think there may be different states and different regions that have passed a protect the flag statute. And I know it was debated in Congress at one point, but it's not been passed because though it does exhibit patriotism, that act, it also is an infringement against the First Amendment of the Constitution, against freedom of expression. In fact, there was an episode of The West Wing where there was a flag essentially burnt in the White House as part of a kid's party. A magician made it disappear in a flame, and it made headline news that a flag was burnt in the White House, and et cetera. Either way, it's an interesting episode. Penn and Teller, is that their name? The magicians, they appeared in that episode, and they're the ones who made the flag disappear in a very patriotic puff of smoke when they spoke about the flag may disappear, but the Constitution remains, whatever it is. So flag currency. So it turns out, if you own an incredibly rare piece of art, it may well be illegal for you to destroy it. Even if it's fully yours, you have complete possession of it. But if you've got a rare Rembrandt, it could be illegal and punishable in court for you to destroy it. Recently, these laws were made in the 90s, and I think the 80s and 90s. I buy Rembrandt, I'm just full of money and I don't care about culture. I buy Rembrandt because my parents love culture and I can't stand my parents, and I hang it on the wall and I invite my parents around, come look at my Rembrandt, and I say, sit here and look at my picture. And then I take a nice little tray of darts and I start throwing the darts at the Rembrandt. That was the case he discussed in this book. I can't remember the title. You can look it up, about whether you can destroy anything or not. There was a debate actually in South Florida one year, I think it was in the 70s, it was a piece in the New York Times, where there were a group of survivors who went to auction and purchased a yacht that had been designed for Hitler. I don't think he ever purchased it or it was ever delivered or something, but it was an anniversary of the liberation of one of the camps, and they decided they were going to purchase this yacht, take it out to the ocean in the Florida Keys, I think, and sink it. As a symbol, and they were possibly transgressing criminal statute for something that was of historical worth, destroying it intentionally. It turns out that it was organized by Jews, so they tried to sink it, but they sunk it in the wrong place, and there wasn't enough depth, and it just kind of sat there, so they had to get somebody else to lug it away. But either way, that was a piece in the New York Times, which came up as I was looking through Dante. Putting those who destroy their own property in the seventh circle of hell, those who commit violence against self. And of course, the kind of the summit of self-violence would be taking one's life. And that's this realm of the seventh circle is called the forest of suicides, where Dante, which is why when I explained this or taught it to the class, I suggested that we need to be very limited in what we are speaking about. And I tried to introduce the halachic context for what we deem halachically to be considered suicide as a crime in Jewish thought. And it still in many ways carries that intonation in English. I mean, if somebody takes their own life, how does we usually express that? What do we usually say that they've done? Now we say they've taken their own life, but how would it usually be expressed?
Murder.
You've committed suicide.
Committed suicide is often how it's expressed. Oh, is that Akiva?
Yes, it is, Rabbi.
Akiva from my Dante class is cheating on the final by coming to the Parasha Shir. How did he know? Unbelievable. So yes, indeed. I've got so distracted now. You're going to have to remind me what on earth we're talking about.
That it's committing suicide.
Indeed, that we talk about committing suicide. Now, what does commit mean? Commit has the intimation of crime. We talk about committing murder, committing fraud, committing theft. And that's why if you ever see on the news now reporting of a case of somebody prominent taking their own life and it makes the headlines, they've tried very hard to shift the way they speak about it. And they don't say they committed suicide, because commit sounds criminal. They say they took their own life, or often you'll hear they died of suicide. And that can sound like a grating term, like, oh, it's the PC police coming along. They died of suicide. But the suggestion is that for somebody to take their own life, they have to have been suffering physically, mentally, at some level, to have driven to this point, that it's essentially an illness that led them to do this. And they died of an illness, which we'll call suicide, because that's how they died. And what Dante does when he puts these people in suicide, and he treats them remarkably, these figures you meet there, and you meet actually a political operative here who was fired by his representative, his boss. It was Frederick II, the emperor of the empire at the time, of the Holy Roman Empire, who fired him essentially unceremoniously. And this figure said, I'm done. I've got no role. I've got no purpose. I've been rejected by my political sphere. And he took his own life. And the suggestion was that he ideologically gave up on life. He wasn't suffering. He wasn't in pain. He wasn't in a sense of despair. And that's essentially the Jewish view as well. Now, I see we're coming up on the end, so I'm going to have to get to the actual part of usury. That's the second part. And the third part of hell, we said, was violence against others, violence against self. And the last is violence against God. Now, how do you commit violence against God? God is ephemeral, intangible. How do you commit violence against God?
Blasphemy.
Excellent. Say that again, Diane.
Desecrating his laws.
Okay, so that's interesting. So that's broadly speaking betrayal. And actually those who are, that's the deepest circle of hell for Dante, traitors. So Ellie, who's obviously a aficionado in the works of Dante, blasphemy, exactly, are the first figures in the figure from last week's parasha, the end of Parashat Emor, the blasphemer, is where he's not found there, but that's the figures who are found there in that third part, people who blaspheme, who attack the name of God themselves. And then you have two more groups, most unexpected. The next group is homosexuals. And how is that violence against God? And his suggestion is it's not violence against God, but it's violence against God's child, which is nature. Which again, when I went through this material with Akiva and his classmate, we discussed at length about how homosexuality was viewed within the church in the medieval period, how it was viewed by the church today, how it was viewed by halakhic life in the medieval period and today, and how we can read this. And that's at least how Dante viewed it. And then we've got the usurers, who were violent against God, not cruel to their friends, Ellie, for these figures, but violent against God. And this because it's not the child of God in nature, but the child of God that's called Ark. So it turns out for Dante, medieval Christians, usury is a crime because it's violent against art. Now, how on earth is this violence against art? You're probably thinking about me throwing darts into my Rembrandt again. And it turns out when they speak of art in medieval texts, they tend not to be speaking about pieces of decorative paint, but they mean art as in mechanical art, as in craftsmanship, labor, work. And usury was seen as a crime against craftsmanship, against getting your hands dirty. So for the church that said this wasn't just about not lending to your friends, but commercially you can't be a usurer is an offensive term, not because you're mean. A miser is a term that's called because you're mean. A usurer was because you were essentially, for want of a better term, lazy. And it was a criminal laziness. So what do? I'm sitting here, a descendant of coal miners. I'm not, for the record, but if I was. And I get up every day at the crack of dawn. I put on my suit, not my suit, my uniform. I put on my helmet. I go to the mines and I work a full day's work. If I'm a farmer, I go out to the field and I get my plow and I make those furrows and I crop those seeds and I water them and I rake them, and I am exhibiting work. I'm laboring as God intended us to do as we left paradise. And what do you do if you're a usurer? You wake up at 10 in the morning. Somebody comes to your office. You open up your wallet and you say, all right, how much do you want? You hand it to them and you say, I'll give you $1 million and I'll expect $2 million back in 3 months. You just made $1 million and you barely breathed. You didn't do a thing. You didn't lift your hand. And it was seen as an offensive vocation, violence against God, who intended us as human beings to be animate creatures, to be laboring creatures. And of course, so they said it was prohibited, not just because it was uncharitable, but because it was an offense against God, which means that Jews who were forced into becoming money lenders were not only seen as miserly and uncharitable, but as ungodly. They were seen as demonic. They were seen as subhuman. And it wasn't just because they were seen as cruel, but because engaging with usury was seen as unnatural, was seen as a debasement of us as a Tzelem Elokim. So it kind of was a vicious circle where Jews were given this task because they were dehumanized, and that task further dehumanized. But either way, I think Eli's right. In the Jewish reading, there is no quote unquote usury, unnatural criminal commercial behavior, which is why Jewish banks will lend with interest, why we do permit that, even from person to person, if it's in a commercial setting. There is no obligation for you to lose money. And the truth is, I'm not an economist, I'm not an expert on the history of economies, and I've no idea if inflation is endemic to markets or not. And it could be that 500 years ago, you lent someone money without interest and you made it back in full, you didn't lose anything. Today, if you lend somebody $1,000 for a year and you get it back, you've lost money because of inflation. So that $1,000 is worth less than it was a year ago. So there is no obligation in halachic life to lose money. There is an obligation to be charitable to your family and to your friends, which is why you're allowed to lend with interest to people who aren't Jewish, not because they're less human or because you can be cruel to them, but because you don't have to be charitable to everybody. And it makes sense to be charitable to your kin, to have a society that functions on the principles of charity. But in the same way that we'll have tariffs against foreign importers, you may charge with interest to foreign entities. It's a reasonable way to run an economy. So I guess we made a way to the end of Bahar. B'chuk Otai we'll have to deal with next year, which has all the curses. And Akiva, if you come back, we'll do a different circle of hell. The final is due on May 24th. So get cracking. Good luck. And in the meantime, I want to thank you all for your patience. I want to thank the Grossmans and the Iskwitzes for their sponsorship this evening again. And I'm here if you've got any questions, follow-up thoughts. But otherwise, I wish you all a wonderful, wonderful Shabbat. Please, God, I look forward to seeing you. You've all been teased now with the Shavuot schedule that's come out. And please, God, it should be a wonderful catalog of speakers. Larry, in fact, will be launching the program on Erev Shavuot before the first Maariv, which we're incredibly excited for. Even though he says I shouldn't be excited, and I make a habit in life not to get excited, but I couldn't help it in this instance. And we have Judah Rosenzweig speaking one afternoon as well. So, Debbie, you can thank him. Oh, he's behind you. You can throw something at him to thank him. Mazel Tov for this Sunday on the wedding. I'm sure life is incredibly busy. And we look forward very much to all our learning. And as I say, please God, there will be a 3 a.m. barbecue. Of course, following all the appropriate measures to keep everybody safe, and please God, everybody fed and happy.
Women's Tikkun, Jane will be speaking. I'm looking to see if anybody else is on here that's going to be on the program.
Right, Jane, Miriam, Shani, and Ora. My wife. Excellent. And it promises to be a wonderful program. So I look forward to that. And oh, indeed. and have a wonderful evening. Erev Tov.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night, Jerry.
Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
Have a good Shabbos.